yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything that they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all your 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show, Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to look at the recent U.S. GDP revisions. Very interesting. But then we want to talk about a little bit more about two debt deals that were recently concluded. One, just yesterday, the IMF concluded. Well, it wasn't the IMF. We'll explain how. The Ukraine debt deal. We'll talk about the Ukraine, which is in a depression and is going to get worse. And then we're also going to talk about the recent signed Greek debt agreement, the restructuring, the third one in 5 years here, just signed off in a memorandum of understanding this past August 14th. So a tale of two debt deals is the second part of the show. But first, let's talk about the first part, which is to take a look at this U.S. GDP figures here. We've been talking about GDP a lot, but it deserves another comment here, because what came out a few days ago was a revision of the gross domestic product for the U.S. Now, as some of you may know, there are three reports on every quarter on what the GDP is. The first is called the preliminary report. That comes out pretty soon after the end of the quarter, but it's preliminary. And then they have a revised report that comes out 30, 60 days later when more information comes in. And then much later they have a third adjustment, usually very small adjustment here statistically, and you know, they sort of tie the loose ends up. Every year or so, they also have what they call a retro, going back several years, adjustment. But we're not going to talk about that. Well, we've had the second adjustment here for the first quarter and second quarter of this year. Okay? You know, that's kind of maybe the one that people look at, because they know the first quarter is preliminary. But the point is this. The point is these second adjustments have been so volatile, so radically different than the first adjustment, that there's something going on here. I'll explain that. Generally, the adjustments are not as big as they have been recently. A few days ago, this second adjustment came out, and it showed that in the second quarter we had a growth not of 2.2%, as was the preliminary indicator for U.S. GDP, but it was a whopping 3.7%. Wow, like 1.5% swing from the preliminary to the second adjustment. That's kind of unprecedented. We're getting these big swings in these adjustments. And it could indicate that they're having some trouble at the Commerce Department with estimating GDP, and they're not really telling us about it. What's another indication of that? Well, the following. Isn't it curious? Over the last 4 years, in the winter months, the winter quarter, the fourth quarter, you know, October to December or January to March, we, 4 years in a row, get this collapse of the economy in terms of GDP measurements. You know, the GDP falls to zero, or maybe 0.1% growth, or sometimes even 2 or 3/10% negative. And that's what happened here again the fourth time in the first quarter. It had dropped to negative 0.3. Well, they revised that back up, of course, twice here to a positive 0.6, which is, you know, virtually nothing. no growth, you know, either way, whether it's negative 0.3 or 0.6, you know, really stagnant growth. But that's happened every winter for four winters in a row. And then what happens is in the summer, the spring quarter and the summer quarter, we get an excessive surge of GDP. You know, it's 3, 4%. You know, so in the winter month, half of the year, it's real low, and in the spring and summer, it's extra high. Well, that kind of tells me that they're having some these huge swings. Something's going on. When you get a pattern of 4 years in a row, something is going on here. They're having problems with seasonality estimates, in my opinion. For some reason, they're not able to pick up the seasonality, which is a statistical adjustment. You know, when you hear GDP, that's not the actual raw number for the growth of the U.S. economy. That's a statistic, meaning a operation on the real data. What kind of operation? Well, lots of operations on the real data. For one thing, the seasonality adjustment. And the other thing, you know, inflation adjustment. You know, the lower you estimate inflation, the higher your real GDP is going to be. And the higher the inflation is, the lower the real GDP is going to be. Well, you know, they've done a number of things to the inflation estimates to lowball the inflation so they get a higher GDP. You may think that the GDP inflation adjustment has to do with the consumer price index, and those are what we pay for things, but no, it doesn't. There's another price index called the GDP deflator, which is quite conservative, and it's all designed to come up with a much lower estimate than the consumer price index. And the lower it is, once again, the higher the real GDP. Well, that's a statistical operation. There's lots of kinds of statistical operations. Some of them are justified. Some of them, I think, are overdone, and others need to be done. But we're having a problem with U.S. GDP statistics, I think. You know, a couple of years ago, they created another problem with GDP data, and what they did was redefine it. They added new categories that before were costs, and now they are all of a sudden contributions to GDP, and it boosted GDP by about 0.3%. So whatever these real GDP figures that you read in the paper or hear about, you know, just knock off 0.3% to get something closer to the reality. So if we make that adjustment after, you know, backing out the redefinitions they've plugged in to boost GDP statistically, if we back that out, and then if we say, well, you know, the winter numbers are typically too low and the summer, spring are typically too high, so you average them out, you know, you get about a 2% GDP growth or just a little bit less, you know, somewhere between 1.8 and 2.1. And that's been what GDP has been, on average, for 5 years now. In other words, there's no real robust growth in 5 years. Typically, you know, from after a recession, U.S. GDP would grow 4 or 5% for a year or two. Sometimes, you know, even higher for a quarter. Well, we came nowhere near that since 2010, nowhere near it. Why is that? Well, basically because real investment is slowing down in the U.S. and everywhere in the world. Real investment, in other words, investment in real things, in buildings, in structures, in equipment, right? And so forth. That's what we call real gross private domestic investment. Well, that's not really, it's been slowing everywhere. And now, of course, we have this big contraction going on in the oil shale area in the U.S. That has been a lot of the growth, responsible for a lot of the GDP growth. You know, it's this oil shale gas boom located in certain parts of the country, you know, Texas, Oklahoma, North Dakota, to some extent Pennsylvania. That's where this boom has been going on. And, you know, it's boosted jobs. If we didn't have that, the job numbers would be even worse than they are. You know, it's boosted railroads and transport and all these ancillary industries that have benefited from the shale boom as well. If we took the shale boom out, you know, with all the fracking and all the costs to our environment that is produced, if we took that out of the picture, the U.S. growth would be even slower. It would probably be somewhere between 1 and 1.5% per year. I mean, that's nothing. That's stagnation. And it's historically way below, subnormal, way below what the normal recession period recoveries are. So the U.S. economy is, you know, kind of, in my opinion, been no change. You know, if you back out the swings and the seasonality problems and the redefinitions and so forth, you know, we're growing 1 to 1.5%, and that hasn't changed much, and that's way below historical norms in the U.S. And it's largely because we're not really investing in real things that produce real jobs. And the jobs we create, you know, we let businesses hire people part-time, temp, contingent, you know, low wages. That's why, you know, you got unemployment supposedly down to 5.5%, but there's no wage growth. That's because a lot of the people who had full-time jobs have been converted to part-time jobs, so their wages have fallen. And then they hire new people at part-time and temp at lower pay. And of course, that doesn't boost wage growth at all. And the only place you really get wage, we're getting any kind of wage growth, and the real growth is in this shale boom, which is over now. You know, that's absolutely over, and it's contracting. As the U.S. Shale producers and the Saudis fight over you know, the energy market size in the world and drive the price of oil and gas down, and they're fighting it out. You know, the two capitalist wings are fighting it out. The Saudis trying to drive their competitors, new competitors, their U.S. shale oil producers out of business by driving the price down. And the shale oil producers, of course, shut down their less productive wells, and they increased the production on their other wells. And we got a glut still of oil and shale gas in the U.S. And now Iran is coming back on market here, and that'll drive the price down even further. And we have this phenomenon of China importing crude and then sending refined oil out into the marketplace. And all the other oil producers are economically in recession and trouble, so they're just pumping as much as they can, even at the low prices. You know, Venezuela and Russia and Nigeria and so forth, they're just pumping oil as much as they can. So, we've got this thing of global oil prices continuing to fall, and they will continue to fall. You know, they're around $40 a barrel, down from $120. And they're going to fall further. You know, we're going to easily see $30 a barrel here in 2016. And the problem is, when that happens, when oil falls that far, you know, it's inversely related to the dollar, and the dollar rises. And when the dollar rises, of course, you know, it reduces U.S. exports. Okay, so back to the U.S. GDP figures. You know, this is the statistical point that I'm making here. That's important. And when you adjust for what has to be a statistical seasonality estimation problem going on, and the redefinitions, you know, you get U.S. growth about 1.7%. By the way, on this question of GDP redefinitions, we're not the only ones doing it. In fact, we're doing it, you know, more scientifically, you might say, than some of the other countries. I mean, take India, for example. Earlier this year, India boosted its GDP by almost 2.5% by redefining what it was. That's all, you know. It was growing at 4-point-something. Now it's growing at almost 7%. They just redefined it, you know, economic growth by statistical manipulation is what it is. Nigeria has done the same. What is Europe doing? You know, Europe is tweaking it by counting illegal drug dealing and prostitution services. You know, this is at boosting their GDP, and they're all doing that in Europe now. Anything to get it going, right? To get that number up, because you know your GDP number, if it's up, you know, people in the stock market make big money that way. You know, these numbers are important. You either make or lose big money as a result of them, and there's big pressure to keep these numbers as positive as possible. You know, they can't totally fabricate this stuff. I'm not saying that's what they're doing. But, you know, they can cleverly tweak here, tweak there, as the U.S. and Europe is doing. And you know, some of the other economies in the world aren't as clever, more crude in the way they lie about their economy. And you know, you get this 2.5% boost in Nigeria and in India. And by the way, China does the same thing. You know, the way China estimates its GDP, China is not growing at 7%. No way, no how. Right? Now it's becoming out more and more obvious, and people are challenging it from various quarters, various independent sources, and most think China is growing about 5%, at best, 5 to 6%. And some are estimating, like Capital Economics and others, estimating the growth is only about 4.1%. Well, you know, when those who know what's really happening, investors, you know, before they really spend their money, the big boys, they want to know the facts. You know, they know that China is slowing dramatically. And that's why China's stock market is collapsing. You know, that plus the fact that in the spring the Chinese government decided that they were overboosting it and encouraging too much margin buying and too many shadow banks. Manipulating prices in the stock market, you know, the Chinese market rose 120%, 150%, some say, in just 1 year. Well, the government was pumping it up. We'll have a show on China's economy here again in the near future. But China's not growing as much as it is supposed to be, and neither are these other countries in emerging markets, and neither is the U.S., and neither is Europe. So the economic growth is not what it is. Looking specifically at the elements of the second quarter revision of U.S. GDP, what's responsible from that incredible leap from 2.2% to 3.7%? Well, a few things here. Let's look at it. First of all, business inventories have increased significantly. You know, for 4 years in a row, we've had the same phenomenon. In the summer, businesses pump up the inventories thinking there's going to be a big Christmas season, and it doesn't happen. And then they work off the inventories in the winter. Well, maybe that has something to do with the big swings as well. But certainly we have a big inventory growth here adjustment, or it may be just a statistical estimation error on the part of the Commerce Department boys. But anyway, a big surge in inventories, which means there's going to be an adjustment in inventories here in the next third quarter, which, you know, may lower GDP. When you get these big swings up, you know, you usually get them swung in the other direction, too. All right, so, you know, this is a temporary thing, inventory behind this incredible surge of adding 1.5% to the GDP revision numbers. Another contributory area was what's called net exports. And net exports is your export growth minus your imports. So if imports are growing faster than exports, right, you'll get a negative GDP. But if imports are falling, people aren't buying as many imports, right? Even if export production and exports don't increase, you're going to get an increase in GDP. Yeah, it's just a definitional thing. It doesn't really mean you've had increased production. You know, your production and manufacturing can be the same, your exports can be the same, but because people are buying fewer imports, your GDP goes up. Well, if people are buying, consumers are buying fewer imports, it could be an indicator that they're running out of money. They don't have enough money to buy imports. So it could be a negative indicator, not a positive indicator of economic growth. Yeah, that's just the way they define GDP, you see. There's a lot of screwy things going on with GDP. By the way, that's why economists in this country in the National Bureau of Economic Research, who are responsible for defining when recessions begin and end, do not rely on GDP. You know, the typical public thinks that a recession is two consecutive quarters of negative GDP. Nope. That's not how they define it, because of the problems with GDP numbers. How did he define it? Oh, no one knows the formula, but it's kind of like a quasi-consensus among a group of named economists who belong to the NBER, National Bureau of Economic Research, it's like sort of an elite group of economists. And what do they look at? Well, they look at a bunch of indicators. They look at employment, not unemployment, employment, retail sales, industrial production, manufacturing, and in a kind of eclectic way, we don't know, it's, kind of like selecting the Pope. They decide that, recession has started, recession has ended. It's not GDP. Specifically that defines a recession or not. Okay, so we got an inventory over investment. We got this strange anomaly here of net exports, imports falling, no real production increase in the U.S., but that raises GDP. And then we have this number here that really perplexes me, and that is commercial construction. In other words, structures. Commercial structures, office buildings and hotels, industrial plants, resorts, things like that, right? Commercial construction. And talk about a swing in the numbers in the adjustment here. This is what we have. In the first preliminary estimate for the second quarter GDP, commercial construction structures fell by 1.6%. But in the revision, it rose by 3.1%. And that was a swing of 4.7%. How the hell did you get that? That's incredible. That can't be real. That has to be some sort of statistical operation that gets that kind of a swing. It's not hard to really identify how many malls and hotels and industrial plants have been built. I mean, it's not like, you're trying to find out how many people bought this or that consumer good, right? They're kind of obvious, and the data's pretty good. So how the hell did they get that swing? Huge swing. And of course, commercial construction added big to this revision in the GDP numbers, big time. Oh, and then how about consumer spending, which is two-thirds of GDP? Well, if you look at it, it's mostly automobiles that still keep chugging along. U.S. auto sales, one half of all the gain in consumer spending was autos. Well, do people really have all that money to buy automobiles? Which, is getting kind of long in the tooth, the auto recovery here, auto sales recovery. Can't last too much longer, but they're providing such attractive discounts. People can buy just about any car they want for $1,000 down or nothing sometimes. So people are just buying these things. It's easy. It's kind of like the subprime houses. In fact, it's very like that because the auto companies are pricing and discounting so low, making it easy for people to scoop up these new cars and trucks because what they do once you buy it, they take your loan and they, guess what they do with it? They securitize it. They create a derivative out of it and they sell your auto loan to people around the world. Well, that's just like the subprime mortgages. It's the same thing going on. Yeah, except it has to do with autos. We got the next crash and a lot of unemployment and everything. People are going to be turning their keys over. A lot of people who are buying the investors, speculators, who are buying the securitized derivative auto loans are going to lose a lot of money here. Okay, that's very tenuous, very tenuous. A better indicator of the economy is how prices are slowing. If the economy is doing well and booming, well, you're going to get some reasonable inflation. You're going to get 2, 3, 4% inflation. Well, all the price indicators have been slowly disinflating. In other words, the rate of growth has been lower, lower, lower. And we have inflation in this country now 1% or less. It's almost deflation. Oh, well, it's the same in Europe. It's the same in Japan, everywhere, right? Part of this lack of real investment going on is and the lack of real money to buy real things by most households is that the prices are for goods and services are slowly slipping towards, you know, slinking towards deflation. And that's the better indicator, I think, of what's happening to the real economy, because if it was really growing, it would be robust. It would we would see more inflation than we are. Oh, but the Federal Reserve pumps all this money in with the whole idea to try to boost prices, right? Yeah, but the money's not getting into real investment. The money is going into financial speculation. It's going into stocks and bonds and the foreign exchange and derivatives and offshore and so on and so forth. Of course, offshore, the markets there are collapsing, aren't they? Stock and bond markets everywhere. So the money's rushing back and coming back to the U.S. And to the U.K. in some extent towards to Europe, you know. And that means the emerging markets are in deep doo-doo. Ooh, that's the big area, big problem area right now. And that's going to get worse, much worse. And no one knows the impact that's going to have. Watch very closely. Well, I talk about emerging markets and this crisis in China and so forth in my forthcoming book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. It comes out in about another month, where all this is addressed in detail. Anyway, to sum up on U.S. GDP, you know, there's statistical problems, there's adjustment problems. I don't believe these numbers. I don't think they're cooking the books. I think they're just making mistakes, and they don't know how to deal with the seasonality issue here. You know, this 3.7% is very tenuous. So what happens in the summer, and the factors behind it can disappear and will disappear dramatically here. Probably in the fourth quarter we'll see it again, although we're certainly going to have less growth in the second quarter. And in the second quarter, of course, all these problems in China, emerging markets, have yet to be reflected in the U.S. Data. But they will be. There's no way that what's happening in China, both the collapse of the stock market, the slowing of their real economy, the devaluation of the currency and all that, there's no way that can't not affect the U.S. economy, including the stock market. You know, we see a 2,000-point drop in the Dow. There's been a little recovery since then, as there always is when things start heading down in a bear market. You know, you always have these periods where bear market bounces or dead cat bounces here in the market, and that's what we're going through right now. But it'll turn down again and continue to fall, just as China's economy, stock markets are going to continue to fall. There's no way a bubble of 150% increase in 1 year can be prevented from unwinding. The best that the Chinese government can do is slow and regulate the unwinding, keep it from happening all at once. But it's going to cost them a lot of money. They've already spent about $300-400 billion trying to slow the collapse, and they'll spend more. But you know, there's no way to prevent that from unwinding. And as the China unwinds, so do the emerging markets. And as their current China's currency falls, so does the currency exchange rates of Brazil, Indonesia, Turkey, all these other countries, South Africa, Australia, all of them. And if the U.S. raises its rates, that will drive the currencies down even further in emerging markets in China. And if Europe and Japan keep pumping money into their economies and the global economy by means of new versions of their quantitative easing, which I predict they will do, that will drive currencies down even more. And then we have this strange thing of Larry Summers and Ray Dalio, who's a big hedge fund guy, coming up this week and saying, oh, we need a QE4 in the U.S. You know, all these guys are interested in is keep the free money flowing from the Federal Reserve to keep, you know, our stock prices up and our, you know, speculation and financial asset markets up so we can keep making money hand over fist by financial speculation instead of making real things. That's all these guys want. And, well, you know, why does Larry Summers say this? Because Larry Summers is a whore for the big banks, you know? He always has been. And he's just trying to pump it up. You know, he's their mouthpiece, one of their mouthpieces. That's all. Always has been. And, you know, he's trying to curry favor here and trying to get himself another government job down the road, probably. But he's got a nice pulpit, you know. He gets to write all the articles, editorials that get printed in the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, or, you know, whatever he writes. You know, they're actually calling for a QE4. Can you believe it? QE4 after the U.S. has pumped almost like a four-something trillion dollars in just QE into the economy? They want another one? You know, when I say economy, I don't mean just U.S. I mean global economy. They want even more. Well, that's because, you know, Japan's going to come up with another QE2 or 3. I don't know what it is, you know. And Europe is going to come up with another QE2 when this one runs out. They're addicted. They're addicted to free money. The capitalists are addicted to free money, and their central banks are accommodating them, pumping it out there, not for the purpose of increasing the real economy. I mean, how much more proof do you need that QE and monetary liquid injections from the central banks have no effect on the real economy? We have 5 years of proof of this. Get it straight. This is all about pumping up stock and bond and other financial markets. That's all it is. And now that the financial markets look pretty shaky and they're starting to unwind, they say, well, pump it up again, guys. Keep it going. Pump it up again. And that's what this is all about. Right? So that's it for U.S. GDP. We're going to take a little break, and we come back. I want to talk about the tale of the two debt deals, Greece's debt deal and the Ukraine's debt deal, just signed off here a day or so ago. Okay, very interesting, because we got a new kind of colonialism emerging here in Europe. All right, so let's just take a little break, and we'll come back. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.
Come soaked in treasure and blood. Here we stood the job. Now we'll stand the flood. There's a new world coming. I can see the light. I'm a jack of all trades.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
It's the BRONX. You know what's next.
It's a bowl of soul. And get your dose of classic soul and independent R&B music from the United States and abroad on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A Bowl of Soul is a music experience you won't forget or regret. Check out A Bowl of Soul on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Okay, second half of the show. We want to talk about the tale of two debt deals recently signed off. And it's not the end of the restructuring and the problems. And we're talking about Ukraine and Greece. Okay, Greece, you know, we've had this issue with Greece since the beginning of the year, haven't we? Where Syriza, the new center-left party, comes into power. Comes into power promising to do something about the debilitating debt payments that Greece has to make to what's called the Euro Troika. Troika meaning three. And that's the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the IMF. When the whole crisis begins here in January, Syriza comes in power and is able to get a majority in the Greek parliament, replacing the other parties that were there that were just kiss-asses to these to the Troika, doing whatever the Troika wanted, and skimming off the top for themselves. Syriza comes in power. That's the name of the party, Syriza. And it comes in power based on a program promising the Greek people that look, we're gonna get the Troika to eliminate some of this debt, expunge some of this debt, and we're gonna get the Troika to agree that we're gonna lower our payments to them so that we can use some of the money that we're generating, you know, in taxes and so forth. We can use some of the money to grow the Greek economy. The Greek economy has been in a bona fide depression for 5 years, since 2010 when they had the first debt deal. 2012, another debt deal made things worse. And going into January here, Greece owed you know, something like $320 billion to the Troika, $320 billion. Well, hell, their GDP is only like $180 billion a year. And if they were growing at 5% a year, you know, which is impossible, if they were growing 5% a year, you know, that's what, $8-9 billion over other expenditures. If they didn't spend on anything else, and they took all of that extra growth and they used it to pay debt, well, you know, just divide $9 billion into $320 billion, and it would take them 30 some years to pay off that debt. If they continued growing 5% for 30-some years and they gave every penny to the Troika, well, there's no way that could happen. Right? And that was the situation going in based on the 2012 debt, second debt restructuring. So Syriza comes in and says, hey, you know, this is unsustainable. You know, we can't be in the depression forever. Because part of these deals in 2010 and 12 is that, in addition to the economic growth, if you don't have economic growth, you just got to pay us the $9 billion or whatever it is by cutting spending. You got to take it out of the hides of the Greek people and Greek businesses, you know. And if you're not growing and creating the revenue to pay us, well, then you got to cut. Well, the problem is cutting makes sure that you don't grow. So it's always been cutting, reducing government spending, and of course that just drove Greece down deeper and deeper. They, you know, 25% unemployment or more, and you know, GDP falling every year for the last 5 years. Stuck in a depression, perpetual depression, because they have to make payments to the Troika. Now, how did we get this debt in Greece in the first place? Well, it all started with the creation of the euro in 1990, and the Germans, now in a catbird seat in terms of exports within Europe, pretty much giving money, lending, getting the banks to lend money to the Greeks and the Spaniards and, you know, the Portuguese and the Irish and so forth, lend money to these countries so they could buy the German exports. And, you know, so the Germans and the Dutch and so forth, they recycle this money and they make profits out of the sale of their exports, and then they make profits, their banks make profits, because the debt accumulates in Greece and elsewhere and they have to pay interest on it. So, you know, they get two bites of the apple at the expense of the rest of the Eurozone. And that's what you've got in the Eurozone. You got a two-tier here. And, you know, those in the north have a sweet deal and indebting people in the south, and in the east, to buy their goods, and then making them pay interest on buying their goods. You know, it's a sweet deal. And, of course, what happens is the debt accumulates. And then what happened in 2010 with the crash, you know, the Germans stopped lending. and said, okay, we're not going to give you any more money to buy our goods. What you're going to have to do is take it out of the hide of your people to pay the interest on this debt that's already accumulated. And then Europe went into another recession in 2012, and they had to add more money. That's how they got the $320 billion in debt as they entered here 2015. And Cerezo says, no, this is not sustainable. It's got to change, right? And they came in promising the Greek people that we're going to reduce the debt load and we're going to end austerity so we can grow. Okay, then we got into this big six-month negotiation. And the outcome of the negotiation essentially was that the Troika kicked Syriza's ass. Yes, they did. That's due for a number of reasons. A number of reasons that have to do with bad strategy, bad tactics on the part of Syriza, naive expectations that the liberal wing of the capitalists in Northern Europe would side with them and realize the factual situation that Greece could never grow out of this thing and the debt was unsustainable and give them some relief. But that didn't happen, you know. I mean, the Troika and the bankers and the investors and their politicians in Northern Europe were pretty much united throughout this whole thing, playing soft cop, hard cop. You know, France would be soft cop, and the European Commission would be soft cop, and the hard cop would be Germany and Wolfgang Schäuble and his other central bankers' friends throughout Europe. You know, and Plan A and Plan B and all that stuff, but they remained united. And what happened with Syriza, they just backtracked step after step after step, and they didn't plan for any real face off. It was always, you know, please, please. It was concession bargaining. You know, if you've ever been in a union and you've seen what happens with concession bargaining for 30 years here, right? The more you concede, the more they want you to concede, and it's a never ending story. You back up, they're going to push you because they think you can go further back. And they'll keep pushing and pushing you till you stand up and say no more, and you fight them, right? And that's the only way to stop concession bargaining. Well, that didn't happen with the Greeks. They just kept backing up. And then finally at the end, Syriza's prime minister there, Alex Tsipras, lost his nerve and completely capitulated. Well, part of the problem is Syriza is a formation, a political party formation made up of petty bourgeois middle class types and some working class types, they just lost their nerve. You know, those small business types will always lose their nerve in a face off with their big cousins. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, history is full of these examples. And that's exactly what happened, you know. And somehow we got to understand what this was all about in Greece. You know, what are the lessons of this? Well, I believe what we got emerging in Greece is, in essence, a new kind of colonialism within the heart of Europe itself, you know, on the periphery of Europe. And that's what the Greek debt deal represents and the Ukraine debt deal. Well, how is it a new colonialism? Well, colonialism is all about extracting wealth from the colony. And you can extract that wealth in a number of ways. In the 19th century, they would extract it by requiring the colony to work and produce low-priced goods, low-cost goods that they would sell back to London or, you know, Paris or whatever, very, very cheap. And then Paris and London, whatever, for the colonies, they would resell the stuff at a higher price and make a profit. You know, that's direct extraction of wealth on the backs of the people in the colonies. Well, that was 19th century colonization, and part of that to ensure that this continued was the colonizers, European capitalists, what they did was install a bureaucracy in those countries to make sure that they would continue producing at low cost and shipping this stuff to their homeland. And if necessary, you know, they had some military force when people would get out of hand and protest this to slap them down. All right, that's 19th century colonialism. 20th century colonialism, a U.S. version, much more clever. And that is the U.S. Has its colonies, economic colonies, which it runs jointly with the local elites. In other words, it's too costly to set up your own bureaucracy and occupy these countries. What you want to do is form a partnership with the local elites and give them a little taste of the profits from the wealth extraction and let them rule with you, the U.S., behind the scenes. And whenever the local rulers got out of hand, you know, like in Chile or whatever, you know, here comes the CIA, here comes the U.S. military, whatever. And, you know, we straighten you guys out, right? And then we retreat again and let them run their show as long as they keep the profits running back. And the U.S. version was also, instead of just having the locals produce this stuff, we're going to send our multinational corporations in there because they can produce it even more cheaply, you see. Just, we just want your resources there and your cheap labor, but we're going to let our multinationals come in, and that's what free trade is about, you know, foreign direct investment. And they're going to come in, and they're going to produce real cheaply, and they're going to sell to the rest of the world. They're not going to just send the goods back to the United States. The U.S. corporations are going to use these countries, these colonies, as a base for shipping goods to the rest of the world. So it's a much more efficient system, much more profitable. But what we got in Europe, I believe, emerging is a new kind of colonialism, and that is where you're not going in and producing goods. What are the goods that the colonizers are selling to the colony that they're making profits off of? Debt. They're selling them debt. And once they sell them the debt, the colonies have to keep finding ways of extracting wealth and sending it to the colonizers, the home colony, you know, the colonizers. And that's what you see in Greece, right? I mean, they got them up to their ears and elbows in debt, and they have to keep paying interest on the debt. There's no products made here, you know? It's debt. Debt is the product. It's colonization and wealth transfer by financial asset transfer. Wealth extraction by financial asset transfer. And we're going to sell you this debt, and you're going to pay on this debt forever to us. We're going to get this perpetual income stream coming back, you know, to Germany and German banks and so forth from Greece and all these other places. That's the new colonialism. And if you look at the deal, the Memorandum of Understanding that was just signed on August 14th in the Greek debt deal, in order to ensure that you keep, these colonies keep paying this interest on this debt, keep making these financial transfers, what do they do? Well, they send in their consultants and representatives now to make sure that the financial extraction and transfer continues. Greece no longer has an economy. It's no longer a Greek economy in this deal. It is the Troika's economy. Well, how so? What's the evidence of that? Well, the evidence is that in this memorandum, unlike all the debt restructuring deals previously, the Troika and its representatives and what they call our own independent consultants, in other words, their people, they're sending them in to manage the Greek economy, really. They're taking over the Greek banks, right? They're replacing people on the boards of the Greek banks with their own industrial consultants. There's a provision in this memorandum that says Greek Parliament and Greek government at any level cannot legislate or take any kind of action without the prior approval of the Troika. In other words, you can't decide anything. You are no longer sovereign. You have to get our approval on any legislative or other action that somehow may remotely affect this memorandum, i.e. the financial flows. And just about any kind of economic action could be defined as influencing the level of the financial flows. Yes, that's you know the umbrella coverage there. No action without prior approval of the Troika, first of all. And what does that mean? That means that the Troika is going to define the new budget. And that's in the memorandum, too. You can write the budget, but we're going to be right there at your shoulder, our representatives, our consultants, to say whether you can do this or you can't do this. Yeah. Okay. You know, so, in effect, Greeks writing their own budget means, you know, they may use their own PC or laptop or whatever, pencil. But, you know, the industrial, the independent consultants of the Troika are right there Xing and redding out whatever they don't like, right? They're going to take over the Greek Greek banks. All the memorandum provides for the sale of all the Greek banks offshore, out of Greece, subsidiaries and branches. Yeah, they're going to buy them up, take them up, right? This money, this $98 billion new loan, right? $27 billion, the first $27 billion is going to go to pay the existing debts. And maybe $25 billion more is going to go into where the Greek banks that are now really not Greek banks anymore. And that money is going to be kept in Luxembourg. They're not even going to let that money sit in Greece anymore. Not only write the new budget, there's a whole, I mean, you read the memorandum, and the tax system is defined in great detail. All the taxes are going up on everybody, you know, on households, the value-added tax, fees, licenses, farmer's tax, everybody's going to be taxed now, you know, to make sure that these payments, financial flows, go back to the Troika and the bankers that sit behind the Troika and those economies in the north. They're going to write the new budget for Greece. So Greece has no monetary policy because it really has no banks anymore, and has no fiscal policy because the budget is really written, vetoed, whatever, by the representatives of the Troika. The welfare safety net, the World Bank's going to come in and redefine that, and cut money out of that. The whole legal system is going to be rewritten. The Greeks have nothing to say about how the non-performing loans in the Greek banks are going to be handled. In other words, the Troika will figure out who gets to buy that debt at good prices in the northern Europe. And then there's what's called the privatization fund. You know, one of the issues as Sarissa came in was, you know, this privatization thing here, selling off public assets and so forth, you know, that was part of what they had a problem with. But now there's a new privatization fund of $50 billion. Yeah, $50 billion. In other words, you're going to have to sell off $50 billion worth of Greek government assets, $50 billion. Well, what does that mean? Well, they're already identified 27 airports that are going to be sold, and then there's the seaports and the docks that are going to be privatized, then the electricity grid is going to be privatized. Watch the prices go up for electricity. The other utilities, and, you know, just about everything's going to be privatized and sold off. Guess to who? Well, whoever the Troika decides, because the Troika is going to sign the checks. So it'll be Northern Europeans. They're looting Greece. They're looting it. Well, isn't that what colonialism is about? Looting the host of, you know, the colony? And that's exactly what's happening. By the way, I have another book that I've been asked to write called Looting Greece. Yes. All right. That'll come out afterwards, maybe a couple months down the road here. Well, this is a new kind of colonialism. You have a new kind of bureaucracy of experts, independent consultants, and representatives of the Troika, you know, who won't formally take control, but they'll be there sitting over the shoulder of Greeks, politicians, elected politicians, and bureaucrats and administrators, whatever, deciding whether they can do or not do something. It's the end of Greek democracy, of course, right? But even more than that, it's a new form of colonial wealth extraction. And this is what's new. You see, in the past, these debt restructurings, Argentina and elsewhere, you know, Russia in the 90s, was, okay, here comes the IMF and some of these other central banks and bankers, and they say, okay, this is what we want you to do. We want you to cut your spending by this much. We want you to raise your taxes by this much, you know, end these subsidies to the people, et cetera. But you guys do it, right? We just want to make sure you hit this bottom line in this deal. Well, it's different now. Now they're not relying on the locals to do it. They're sending in their own people to run the show. There's going to be a troika commissar on the shoulder of every Greek administrator and every Greek politician. Now, if that's not colonialism, I don't know what is. Okay. That's the deal there. That's the deal. You know, we have another deal just signed here a few days ago in the Ukraine. And it's even more blatant there, direct management of the country in exchange for the debt deal. You know, there was a debt deal in the 2005, I think, that they weren't, the Ukrainians weren't able to pay off. And then, of course, when you had the coup here a year or so ago, the IMF stepped in and put another $17 billion. And I predicted, I wrote a number of things at the time for Telesur, and I predicted that, hey, look, you know, the $17 billion isn't going to do it. They're going to need $50 billion to bail out the Ukraine. And that's if there was no fight in the East, breakaway provinces, $50 billion. And I predicted Ukraine would be in a depression with their GDP dropping about 10% a year, right? And voila. Well, you know, how much does the Ukraine owe in debt after the deal of about 15 months ago, and the new deal, which is $40 billion more? Oh, pretty darn close to my $50 billion, right? Prediction. And guess what? The economy has dropped a 23% GDP decline since 2012, and it's supposed to drop another 9.5% this year. Yeah. Well, in exchange for even more debt for Ukraine, what has to happen, what did happen was the U.S. and the Europeans said, you know, we're going to put our people in direct control. We're going to run your economy. And that's what they did last December. An American shadow banker, private equity banker, Natalia Jevesko, was, even though she wasn't a Ukrainian citizen, was put in charge of the finance ministry in Ukraine. This is last December. And a European hedge fund guy, Abramovicius or something like that, he was put in charge of the economic ministry, and he wasn't Ukrainian either. So, you know, the Ukrainians have turned over their economy to Western bankers. Literally, they're running the show day to day. I mean, it's even more blatant than Greece. You know, you got all the experts sitting there on the shoulders of everybody in Greece. But there, the experts are running the show, right? They're not sharing the pulpit with anybody. And, you know, they recently had this negotiation with, the hedge fund people on how much debt they were going to pay them back, the private debt. Not just the IMF debt, the private debt. Guess who Natalia Jevesko, Horizon Capital ex-CEO out of Chicago, now finance minister of Ukraine, was negotiating with? Guess who? Oh, Nicholas Brady, former assistant treasury secretary under Reagan and Bush. Yeah, so two Americans negotiating the fate of the Ukraine in the debt deal. Wow, you don't read that in the front page of the New York Times, do you? Very interesting. So, they just concluded this deal with the private side, and the economy is going to continue to collapse. And in both cases, Greece and Ukraine, there will be another debt restructuring, maybe as soon as next year. Okay, Jack Rasmus, next week, I'm going to have some folks we're going to talk about Bernie Sanders and labor.